anything can be cheeky in the UK. You've also seen that thing where, like, a guy, like an American guy on a forum asks what a cheeky Nando's is. And it's like, oh, you know when you're out with your mate Dino and you're like, oh, let's go Weatherspoon's Curry Club. And he's like, do you fancy a cheeky, he's like, do you fancy a cheeky Nando's? And you're like, yeah, innit, bruv, because he's the Archbishop of Canterbury. And then the second reply from the American guy is, what does any of this mean?
So what's really unfortunate is how much of that sentence I followed. Like, there's, I didn't get all of it, but I knew enough to be able to reconstruct the context, and I don't know what that says about my exposure to the UK.
Yeah. You're a tier boo, my friend.
Yeah. I mean, I know, like, because I do know what a cheeky Nando's is. I get it. It makes perfect sense. Yeah. I the concept resonates with me. I feel like that's not great for me at this stage of my life.
Look, we all, you know, it's good to have something that resonates. I think having a kind of that level of knowledge of the UK is much less embarrassing than having that level of knowledge about Japan, for example.
Yeah. No, if you have that level of familiarity with Japan, like if you know without having run across it somewhere what the role of a hostess is, then like you're a sex freak.
Yeah, the UK has never been less politically cool and more culturally cool than it is right now. Like, I saw this like insane band of Zoomers from New York playing at Glastonbury, and they were all dressed like Liam Gallagher in 1997. And I was like, what is going on? Like, full Adidas tracksuit, like the haircut, the shades. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Truly, English cultural dominance.
Who would have thought that this would be the form that it would take?
Yeah, mad.
Like, that's not what I would have thought. But you know what? There are worse English subcultures to be pulling from than that one. Ooh, I can think of several
most of
worse.
Them. Good God.
That was actually something I wanted to talk about today when we do this episode, is like Roman subcultures. Because I think that would be kind of a fun little,
that's spicy.
Fun little thing.
The subgenre of Milo and Pat on the pod. Hello and welcome to Master of Adamain, the podcast that was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now, at least for the moment, about Spartacus Blood and Sand. I am Milo Evans and I'm joined this week by my co-host Patrick Wyman.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, I'm doing all right. Patrick wasn't here last week, Phoebe isn't here this week. There you go, the rotating podcast of Theseus continues. We're like the sugar babes of watching Spartacus Blood and Sand.
Yeah, we're just, it's a rotating cast of people who have slightly different things to say about the cornucopia of ass, tits, and violence on display before us.
Yeah. Last week, Phoebe and I were discussing how it is a different podcast when it's just me and Phoebe, because the opening 15 minutes of the podcast, God, what were we even talking about? It was something completely mad. It was like the... We were like getting into a philosophical discussion of the Eagles Hotel California and how that hotel would actually work. Like, how could a hotel where you could check out but never leave actually function?
Yeah, how would it make money? I don't like...
Yeah. You're hanging out in the lobby. Maybe you can leave luggage and use the pool. I don't know.
I was more concerned about how would the hotel be compensated for the cost of running the facilities. Unless this is prefiguring remote work by 50 years, I have some questions about the business model.
Yeah. Questions for Don Henley to answer. Probably lower down the list of questions than the Quaalude stuff, but certainly on the list.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, anybody who was famous in the 70s, I think it's fair to say that our opening round of questions will be about Quaaludes.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it feels like that. There's like a sort of amnesty period for doing Quaalude stuff that ended in about 1980. If you did it before that, fine. We have no questions.
Afterward, major questions. Then you're, because if you're still into Quaaludes after 1980, I assume you're on some kind of first name basis with Bill Cosby.
Yeah, and you don't want that.
No.
Don't want that. No.
No. That's a hard no.
Yeah. I think it's the first, like, Quaaludes are like the silphium of drugs, bringing it back to ancient, like, you know, they're like this mythical, you know, everyone was on them in the 70s and 80s, and now they're impossible to get. They're you know, they've disappeared. And so none of us get to know that kind of, that sick ass housewife high that all of the rockers were on.
Embrace tradition, bring back Quaaludes, make America great again by bringing back Quaaludes.
Exactly. And as a sort of gourmand of drugs, it saddens me that I can't try Quaaludes, you know? Let me be clear, because trying Quaaludes for yourself is fine. Giving them to other people is where it gets dodgy.
Very not okay. Very
I want
not
a single person dose of Quaaludes for me.
Just a personal Quaalude.
Yeah. If anyone's getting taken advantage of sexually, it's me. That's fine. I'll take my chances.
In fact, I will be taking the Quaalude at this particular time if anybody has any...
It's like the fucking Bonnie Blue petting zoo, but the podcaster version. Like, yeah.
Oh my God. I the fact that I know who Bonnie Blue is makes me feel like I've done something wrong with my algorithms. Like that I've entered a corner of the internet that's not for me. And it's like, I should be wanting to get out. I should be out. I shouldn't know this. This is like, it's like I've opened Pandora's box of Gen Z shit and I want out. I don't want to know the answers.
Pandora's box is a great name for an OnlyFans account. I Bonnie Blue and Lily Phillips, I think, I do sort of have a respect for, in the sense that I recently came to a crushing realization, which is that, like, I essentially have the same job as them, which is appealing to a mass market online for clicks. And we're all in a race to the bottom of what it takes to get those clicks. And what they're selling is a lot more saleable than what I'm selling.
Yeah.
I've written a joke for the new show, which is like me, Nigel Farage and Bonnie Blue all essentially have the same job. It's just that 1,000 men will queue up to see Bonnie Blue and Nigel Farage. And on that basis, who am I to criticize Bonnie Blue, a woman who's out there securing the bag? Although I will say she is scarier than Lily Phillips.
That's true. She's got a certain intensity about her.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say I find it off-putting, but it is definitely present, and I'm not sure what to make of it. Look, I am who I am. There's a lot of charges I'm not going to beat here. I do not have any issue with that. I have especially as long as you're making your decisions for yourself and you're not being coerced by someone and you are responding with as much free will as possible to the incentives that are placed around you, like, your choice is to make, man. Like,
yeah. And I think, you know, if we're engaging with sex work on the terms that it is work, I think therefore it is analogous to other things. And I, for one, the analogy that's come into my head is professional tennis. And I feel like, you know, Lily Phillips is sort of like the Rafael Nadal of porn. You know, there's a fundamental humanity to her. You can see the struggles that Uncle Tony's there in the stands cheering her on. Like, whereas I would say that Bonnie Blue has a kind of, she has a kind of Roger Federer energy. Like, there's a coldness to Bonnie Blue that unnerves me. There's a methodical, mechanical energy, a Swissness that perturbs me slightly. And it's not because she's engaging in sex work. It's something about her vibe, her aura.
Yeah, it's very, I'm trying to think of the precise geographic indicator, because it is Swiss, but it could also be Austrian.
Yeah.
Like some kind of like.
The Austrians are like the Swiss if they actually stood behind what they really thought, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. She could be from Graz, I guess is what I'm saying.
Sort of Sud Tyrolean Bonnie Blue.
Oh my god. Oh my god. We are way off the rails here, and we're 9 minutes in.
Italy contesting the sovereignty of Bonnie Blue with Austria. it's a dark thought, but look. Yeah,
Romanche speaking Bonnie Blue, is that where we're at?
Yeah. Horrifying thought. We're not here to talk about Bonnie Blue, despite what. If this is the first episode of this you've ever listened to, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's not always like this.
Sincere apologies.
Yeah.
Let's not go that far. It is kind of always like this to some extent.
It's thematically appropriate, because I will say that this episode of Spartacus Blood and Sand features a lot of sex work.
A lot of sex work.
Yeah. Including the lads doing some sex work.
The lads doing, I would say, a gender appropriate amount of the sex work in this.
Yeah. One. Yeah. And I would say, I mean, to be honest, it's they're doing the male fantasy dream kind of sex work, which is like, I will pay you to fuck this MILF.
Yeah. Big gigolo fantasy vibes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Juice Bigelow could never. So yes. This episode, right. Where do we begin?
Where do we even begin?
Yeah. Crixus is back in action.
Yeah, he is. Look, in so many different ways, Crixus is back in action.
In so many different ways. There's a lot of yelling through prison bars. Mm-hmm. There's a bit, we get a bit of Spartacus training some new recruits. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, he's yelling at them about keeping their guard up and so on. I'm getting a bit of Band of Brothers out of this opening sequence. It's very goddamn fucking Replacement's gonna get us all killed.
Yeah, it's just them and it's just them arguing in a pub about who's gonna get killed first.
Those
scenes seem kind of wooden. The acting in this show, be really honest, especially in this season, leaves a great deal to be desired.
Yeah, the wood of the sword they're using in the scene is somehow transmitting through their musculoskeletal structure into the acting.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I would go so far as to say the wooden implements have greater range than many of the characters that we're exposed to on the screen here.
Yes, very true.
With that said, I like what they're trying to do, right? Which is, it seems to me, they're trying to show us how society and community and values can develop among an obviously oppressed group. Right? They're what we're seeing here in these episodes is characters who have been fully institutionalized to the master's worldview, right? And these people are all now just trying to, this is the choice that Spartacus has made, is to be allow himself to be institutionalized into this worldview and to live according to its values, and to see his value as a person or his value as a slave in terms of the way his master views him. And Crixus has had this all along. The other enslaved gladiators, same deal. They're coming to terms with this. The poor guy who gets his dick cut off. And was that the previous episode?
Wait, a guy got his dick cut off?
The gladiator who tries to kill Spartacus, Alithia's pet gladiator.
Oh, she buys. And they cut his dick off?
Yeah.
I've missed that.
When they crucify him, they cut his dick off.
That seems unnecessary.
Because he wouldn't say who put him up to it. Yelded him.
Yeah,
so
you feel like being crucified is bad enough.
Yeah, I mean, I actually appreciated the brutality of that, because that's what crucifixion looked like. That's not an exaggeration. That is a real thing that happened with some regularity in the Roman world to disobedient slaves. We have archaeological evidence of it. we have found the remains of people who have been crucified, and they really did bang the nails right through there. We know because there's one set of remains. I can't remember where it's from, where the nails are still in there. They're corroded, but the nails are still through the hand bones.
Okay, this is interesting, right? Because I was always given to understand that actually the crucifixion of Christ was unusual in using nails, and that they usually just tied people to the cross.
Sometimes.
Okay.
But we have archaeological evidence for doing it with nails. I mean, it depends on the severity of the offense. It depends on where you are, I think.
Right.
But yeah, no, they really did bang nails through there. Yes, that is true that the crucifixion of Christ especially was used to be thought to have been unusually brutal for that reason. But now we have actual firm archaeological evidence of them just doing it, which matches textual accounts and visual depictions. So I appreciated that they didn't take their foot off the gas on that one. Like, if you're, there's a lot of gratuitous violence in this. I don't think that particular scene, as hard to watch as it was, and like, I'm pretty inured to watching violence on screen. That was pretty, despite that, I thought it was the right scene to put in there. That was not gratuitous. That was, this is the world these people are living in. That is the punishment. That's the punishment that we know years down the road, right? We know that that's where these guys are going to end up, a lot of them.
Because well, this is now me reaching back into the memory vault of university more than 10 years ago. Didn't Pompey Magnus once crucify like hundreds of slaves from some kind of slave rebellion all along the Appian Way?
That's what happens to the survivors, captured survivors of Spartacus.
Sorry,
yeah, it's
correct. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, that's very, very famously when there's the whole I am Spartacus thing that we see in the Kirk Douglas Spartacus movie, which is, as so far as we know, an invention. No, they really did. They crucified 6,000 slaves.
Jeez.
So this is a real thing. They did it with some regularity. This was the accepted punishment for crimes against your master. Not so much for attempted escape, because then the slaves still have value. So you would brand them or otherwise physically disfigure them or mark them as an escapee. But for serious, what were thought to be serious offenses against the household, yeah, you're getting crucified.
It's quite surreal, isn't it? Because obviously, for listeners who might not be as familiar with ancient Rome, the Appian Way being like probably the most major north-south thoroughfare in Italy. The idea of you're just like driving down like the main motorway near your hometown, there's just like crucified people alongside of it. You're like, oh, fucking Pompey's at it again. What's happened now?
So I was reading a book not that long ago about warfare in the Hellenistic world. And so the Hellenistic world is basically the Greek East after the conquests of Alexander the Great. So the Greek world that extends all the way deep into Asia, into Egypt, the world of Alexander the Great's successors. Mm-hmm. And one of the points this book made, and the author is specifically talking about the Hellenistic world, but it applies to the entirety of the ancient Mediterranean, is just that war was everywhere. This kind of open brutality and violence was everywhere. It was part of life. People expected it. And so like if you were walking through the Greek countryside, just between two neighboring cities, you would find the remains of old fortifications that had been thrown up at some point. You would find what are called tropea, like the singular is a tropeon. So it's a trophy that you set up with the arms and armor of the defeated after a battle. But the Greek countryside is littered with tropea. In this whole period, you're going to find monuments and burial markers that serve to mark the graves of people who died in battles. and those are the ones that they wanted to remember, right? Like those are the important events. And Italy wouldn't have been much different. They would have used more temples for the deposition of arms and armor instead of tropea. But like, still, these reminders are absolutely everywhere. And yeah, you're going to see an impaled head on a guardhouse going into a city. You're going to see a crucifixion. You're going to see slaves getting beaten for their offenses. That is baked into life in the ancient world in a way that is very difficult for us to understand now. But the fact that it's hard for us to understand doesn't mean that it wasn't real for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess the plot of this episode, your A plot, your main plot that everything is revolving around, is that Lucy Lawless wants Spartacus to shag this Roman noblewoman. And now, I watched this episode on 1.5 times speed because I've been up against it today. And I'm trying to understand, by having watched the episode, but also by rereading the plot summary on Wikipedia, trying to understand what this plot that's going on is. Because we've got...
Okay.
We've got Ilithia, who is the wife of the guy who owns the other gladiator school, right?
No, Ilithia is the wife of the legatus, the one who gets Spartacus in trouble at the very beginning of the show.
Right. Okay.
That's why. So that's why she hates Spartacus, is because Spartacus, remember, they turned Spartacus into the fall guy for why that Thracian campaign went poorly.
Right. Okay.
And yeah, we know that that's not the reality of it, that the Legatus was himself responsible for how it went south. But that's why Alethea hates Spartacus and wants to see Spartacus die violently in the arena in a way that satisfies her.
But Alethea is the one who's always like, she's always like mega horny for everyone, right? She's like,
Yes. She's the high class woman who keeps coming to the Batiatus's place, and she's been slagging Lucy Lawless here. She's been trying to be subtle about it, but Lucy Lawless has not been blind to the many verbal offenses Alethea has offered. So she cooks up a plot for revenge.
Right.
Licinia, who is the cousin of Marcus Crassus, the other high class Roman woman who loves the tea, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely.
She decides she wants to fuck a gladiator. Alethea susses this out and decides not that she wants to get Licinia in trouble for it, but that she too wants to fuck a gladiator. Right. So Lucy Lawless, why can I not remember her name? What's her name? Lucretia. Jesus Christ. Lucretia sets them up on the same night. So rather than giving them separate nights of, you know, masked pleasure with a horse cocked gladiator, she sets them up.
They're crediting Spartacus with some refractory times here. I don't know. I don't know how long they're giving him. I mean, look, this is a man in his 30s.
This is the actor. I mean, perhaps even slightly older. I mean, and also a guy who, as we find out through some repeated and very wooden scenes, has not busted in some time. We are privy to that information as viewers.
Maybe doing that much semen retention does make you quite wooden.
I honestly can't say.
He's I'm got not wood. Familiar. That much we know.
There's a lot of wood. A lot of wood happening. Lucretia turns this into her revenge plot. So rather than having Licinia fuck Spartacus, which was her request, she has Spartacus fuck Alethea. And when they discover what's going on, Spartacus tries to strangle her. She's obviously horrified, and she does it right as Licinia walks in to embarrass Alethea about she's now just fucked her husband's mortal enemy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Great goss for
Alethea. Specifically wanted to fuck a different gladiator.
She wanted to fuck Crixus, and that's why Lucretia was so mad, because
Alethea knew in another woman's gladiator.
Exactly. That's 100%. So Alethea takes this rather poorly and smashes Licinia's face into the stairs. And just leaves her eyeball hanging out, all that good stuff. She's fucking dead. Licinia is not coming back.
Yeah, I mean, eyeball hanging out in ancient Rome, it's not good. It's not what you want.
Tough repair job there. Even the Greekest physician couldn't deal with that.
Even the Greekest physician. The Greek physician leaving a tiny little bit of scaffolding on the outside of your eye socket so you don't come into some, you know.
So in that same Hellenistic warfare book, it had accounts of injuries that people had gone to, like a healing sanctuary of Asclepius or whatever, some healing god, for relief from their war wounds. There were two separate ones where guys were like, I still have a spearhead in my face. Healing god, can you help me with that? It's like, I that's asking a lot. Like, I even divine power
in my face.
Two different guys at the same healing sanctuary.
Well, they were on different sides. They were coming at each other. Miraculously. Now that would be a fun buddy cop movie.
Yeah. So, it's just like Lethal Weapon. They're getting too old for this shit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No diplomatic immunity in those days.
Diplomatic immunity.
Yeah, God. Ancient Greek, South African, what a concept.
Oh, that's, I think that's just the Syracusans.
Yeah, probably, most likely.
That's actually, I kind of tossed that off, but I actually think that's accurate. I think the Syracusans are the South Africans of the ancient Greek world.
Very into trigonometry, not very into ethnic diversity.
A lot of civilian farmer ideology. I would say that they're basically Boers.
Hmm. There you go. We've got the official Masters of Our Domain calipers out. We've determined that the ancient Syracusans are effectively boars.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Look, I think we've made a lot of progress here today.
Absolutely.
On this front,
it's good to build out the taxonomy.
Yeah. Look, you know, on Masters of Our Domain, our dedication to Southern European racial classification is unmatched.
Absolutely.
Never going to do it better than we do.
Yeah, we know our Macedonians from our Greeks.
Epirotes. We know our Molossians from our Illyrians, baby. Like,
absolutely. Don't be coming up to me with a Cappadocian forehead and expect me not to notice. You know, got it all. We've got it all locked in. But yeah, so the outcome of this sort of particular plot line is that Lucretia sort of goes to Ilithia like, it's fine, we'll cover this up. But just like, you know, just between me and you, just between the girls. And so, yeah, we're back in conniving MILF territory.
Oh, she is conniving like a motherfucker. And it's, honestly, from my perspective, hot. I'm here for it.
I love women who can connive.
If there's anything we've been consistent about on this show, it's that we do love the ability to connive.
Absolutely. Especially if she'll connive on your behalf.
Yeah. And look, she is... Say what you will about her, she is dedicated to her man.
Mm, yeah,
that little nipple twist she does on him to get him going when they're that's a caring wife. There's a lot of
horny talking between Lucy Lawless and John Hannah as per usual.
Nobody has ever had more fun, I think, than the scenes that they shot together in this show. They look like they're enjoying themselves.
There's this one bit where she's walking through. Lucretia's walking through with either Licinia or Ilithia through her sort of like brothel bit, I guess. And there are just like 20 naked women just walk past, fully naked, Billy Bollocks in shot, not like obscured in any way. And I'm just like, they were having a lot of fun making this show.
Oh,
it adds nothing to the plot. Nothing.
Nope. It's purely about showing us in the most... Like, this show is a lot like being hit over the head with a hammer repeatedly. Mm. Like, there's...
What a review.
There's nothing subtle about this show. This show is anathema to subtlety. The concept of subtlety has no place in this show. Mm. That doesn't mean that the points that it's making are bad necessarily, but it is the rough equivalent of getting hit with a hammer, which, you know, that's what you're into.
Yeah,
I am. I like it.
You've got a bunch of Australians playing gladiators who are not making any effort to adjust the way they speak. Gosh, Struth Cobber, it's hard yakka being a bloody gladiator. What? I hate to fucking find out what the Dominus wants now.
It's just really surprising that nobody's been called a bogan.
Yeah.
In the filming of this show. I don't know how none of those incidents made it in.
Mm. Yeah, I would like that. I would like the Australian taxonomy of ancient Rome. Is the successful freedman a cashed up bogan?
Yeah. Absolutely.
What is the ancient Roman equivalent of a ute?
I don't know. I have questions. That's basically the plot of the episode, is that this is all about Lucretia's machinations to embarrass Ilithia and the consequences of those. Mm. But at the same time, we've got some lovely subplots with Crixus and Navia, his lady love.
A lot of the men in this show making their lives really complicated. You got old Blondie, whatever the fuck he's called, the one guy who's being a gladiator to get out of gambling debt. And he's just, you know, he's like, my wife's not talking to me since I called her a whore. And it's like, yeah, bruv, like, you fucked it.
Yeah, pretty, I mean...
You're not in a position to negotiate here.
Yeah, in fairness, accurate representation of many men's thought processes. I don't think they're giving the male half of the species too little credit in that one.
No, I think that is quite accurate, but I just routinely, it's long term been a position in my life where I'll just witness things that men do and I'm just like, why have you done that, brother? On a purely self-interested level, you have fucked this.
That's what happens when you have no ability to introspect and very little vocabulary for understanding what you're feeling or doing. That's the look, that's being a dude, baby. Guys being dudes.
And it's another thing they have nailed in this show.
they really have.
Yeah. Yesterday I was working on my stand-up work in progress with my director, and I had this bit in it about where I'm like, oh, well, you know, I'm single, which means I have nothing to tell any of you because dating women is fine, isn't it? You know, it's just, you know, like women are fine. Like they're not, you know, you go on a bunch of dates with men, you're going to have some fucking stories. You go on dates with women, like some of them are bad, but they're bad in a prosaic way that, like, you know, they're not doing anything that's like socially unacceptable. It's just, you just didn't enjoy it. I'm like, there's not this... I'm like, to go into it any more than that would involve mounting a defense of men, which I'm not prepared to do. That is an uphill battle, which I'm not willing to participate in. I know, I have met men, I know what they're up to. I'm not going to stick my neck out for other men.
It's
fucked out there. I know.
Yeah. I have nothing but sympathy for the women who are forced to navigate dealing with whatever the fuck that is. Because that's the, like, I see this, and perhaps it's just the algorithms are messing with this, but I don't think so. I think there's really something genuinely wrong with a whole swath of men and who are completely unable to relate to women as people. And that's, it should work on that. Like, cause yeah, I think that tracks with my experience with dating is sure. I went on a date with a recently minted doctor, and ooh. She was smart. She was interesting.
Is a great, yeah.
She had just gotten through her residency. She had just gotten through her residency, and she was cool. She was smart. But like, it wasn't a bad date. It was just like nothing happened, and there was no interest on either of our parts in having another date. It was like, okay. And that to me is the standard, like, not great date with a woman is you're just like, oh, okay, this isn't going anywhere. That's fine. Have another date.
It's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
A bad date with a woman is like a business meeting. It's just, oh, it was kind of boring, but, you know, fine.
Yeah, off we went at the end of the night. That's all right.
A bad date with a man is like, I'm sending you a 14-minute voice note about what this cunt did.
Yeah, like that. And I live in terror of ever having been the man that was the subject of the 14-minute voice note.
God.
Where I'm like, what did I do that could have put me in that category? I still think about that now. I haven't been dating in 15 years, and I still think about that.
It is a fearful thing, you know, to think that, like, there's it's inherent to the man who's subject to the 14-minute voice note that he's not self-aware enough to understand that. There's like a, and so like it could be, it's Shutter Island. Like, you don't know if it's you.
Oh my God.
Everyone thinks they're the detective, but someone's the madman. Yeah.
Shit. Yeah. Oh my God. That's like a skeleton key metaphor for unlocking a lot of what I'm seeing around me here. Yikes.
It's terrifying. It is.
I'm going to be, dude, you kind of broke my brain a little bit. I'm going to be thinking about that one for quite some time.
I think it also makes it so funny with all the Andrew Tate stuff and whatever, and men who are like, oh, you know, women use their sexual power to not fuck us. And I'm like, so many of my female friends are out there doing what I can only describe as charity work. Like, like when you meet the men who even attractive, well-adjusted, intelligent women are prepared to fuck, and you're saying women won't fuck you, you've got to be doing something so wrong. Like, brother, the bar is so low.
Dude, the number of, so I don't have a lot of single female friends as I'm now old. But the single female friends I do have, when they talk about dating and they talk about men, the number of times I've heard them use terms like, he was only medium ugly. Or
this is another way you can be talked about by women, which is also terrifying.
Yeah.
You're not the 14-minute voice note, but you're being settled for in the most horrifying way.
Yeah. Or it was so sweet. He texted me to make sure I got home okay. I'm like, what? You're describing like the most basic actions that one human can take to show that they care about another. And you're like, oh my God.
I once went on 3 dates with a woman and I sent her a text in the middle of the workday asking her how her day was, and she told her mother about this because how much it had stuck out to her. And I'm like, what is going on out here?
That's not good, man. It's not that's good. So I guess what we're saying is do better.
This has been Male Feminist Corner.
We're trying
to balance out the fucking body blue analysis of the Stark podcast.
These are flip sides of the same coin, sir. Yeah. These are flip sides of the same coin. They flow from the same love, respect, and concern for women.
Yeah.
I think that that we as a whole evince regularly on this podcast.
Absolutely. Even when Phoebe's not here. There you go.
There was a lot of really exploitative sex that happened in this episode. But I think it's worth talking about what was exploitative about it, for whom, and the ways in which that is and is not a reflection of ancient Rome. Does that sound?
Go off, King.
Feasible? Okay. So one of the things I like about the way that they handle sex in this show is that they could glamorize it a lot. As they do in the scene where Spartacus is fucking Alethea, right? Mm. That's what glamorous sex looks like in 2009 in a relatively low budget Starz show. That's glamorized sex. Mm. There is nothing glamorized about the desperation with which Crixus is pounding Lucretia in order for him not to be sold to another owner, right? Mm. Like,
He is literally laying pipe like his life depends on it.
He is. And I think that it's worth that is a very funny joke and I like it. I want to emphasize that as much as I can. But like, we should take that seriously. He is laying pipe like his life depends on it, because it does.
Yeah.
And the extraordinarily good looking, but perhaps lacking in some training, or perhaps the dialogue wasn't very good, the actress who is commanded to go bust one for Spartacus before the big game, her life does literally depend on that, right? And the girl, the enslaved woman that Batiatus is having sex with while Lucretia is twisting his nipple, like, the way in which she's treated purely as an object there, and thrown off, like, to modern viewers, that looks coarse, callous, and it is, but it's also real, right? Like, this kind of sexual exploitation is a recurring and fundamental feature of slave societies and slave households.
Yeah.
And that masters could do that, right? Like, if you own these people, you own them. They are tools for you. And if that's how you choose to use the tool, that is your prerogative as the owner. Now,
and crucially, like, the social dynamic there is very different from sexual exploitation in most of the modern Western world, where whilst it is still bad, in the ancient world it is a sense of, like, well, they're objects. They are, to say they're being objectified is sort of, in a way, they've already been objectified by the fact that they have been legally made objects.
They are speaking tools. They are tools that speak. That is how they are legally and culturally understood. And like, this show does not make sense at a basic level if you can't internalize that's the attitude that the masters have. And the whole show, in all of its gratuitous, often awful visual language, is built on a fundamentally correct interpretation of the way that slave households and the Roman world worked. So,
do you think Starz in 2010 have accidentally done this kind of, like, stopped clocks thing, where they wanted to make a show that was so outrageously sexually exploitative that what they've accidentally done is accurately portrayed ancient Rome?
So I keep going back and forth on this.
Yeah.
And my sense, while having done zero research into what the actual production process and writer's room looked like for this show.
Schrodinger's Spartacus, sure.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that. I think a lot of it is, yes, they're like, let's put in some sex, but there was also at least one person involved in the making of this who really had done the work and really had internalized what the what the dynamics of slave households were like and how these relationships worked. And
I did wonder why Mary Beard kept cropping up in the credits.
I mean, I think there's a lot that someone like Mary Beard would find objectionable about this show. Mm. And I, for reasons that make a lot of sense, I'm not going to argue with those. Mm. But my honest take, having read pretty much all of Mary Beard's work, is that she would see the aspects of this that are genuinely reflective of Roman society and would not disapprove of them. Mm. I think especially historians of her generation, women historians of her generation. And I know I took a great class from a woman whose name escapes me, like an intro to Roman civ class. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she took pains to show us was the kind of wildly different sexual mores of the Roman world. Mm. To the point where this was 2004, and this was kind of the peak of evangelical Christians being mad about stuff like this in the U.S.
At Westboro colleges, Baptist Church protesting soldiers' funerals, etc.
This was the first Bush term. Mm. This was post 9/11 America. The ascendancy of the religious right, and there were multiple evangelical Christian students who got up and left the lectures because they didn't believe or weren't comfortable with what she was teaching. Like,
there's
she
only
had
one
a,
type of Bush that they wanted to see.
That's exactly true. And standing in front of a mission accomplished banner. That's the only one.
Yeah. do you think if you'd have put the mission accomplished banner sort of behind anyway,
it could have worked, but like, that is the Roman world. They did shit that seems strange to us. They did stuff that seems horrible and objectionable to us. And it's incumbent on us as modern people looking back at this to try to make sense of why they did it and how it worked for them. Like, that's the anthropological viewpoint on an ancient society, is to try to understand it on its terms. Mm. And there is a way in which this show really, really leans into that. And I think a lot of it really, is kind of accidental. It's just kind of happens to be thematically concordant, but wasn't put in there to highlight this stuff. But when your guiding principles are pretty much right, most of the stuff kind of tends to fall in place, is my belief. If you've got the right organizing principles and ideas and you pick the right themes, for example, how do enslaved people build their own societies in the face of constant surveillance and oppression? Mm. If that's your core question, then you're going to hit on a lot of stuff that works. And so I completely understand people who can't get past the absolutely lurid and occasionally grotesque nature of the visuals in this show and the wooden acting. I get it. Like, I'm not defending any of that. But somewhere down at the core is a really kind of deep and nuanced understanding of how the Roman world worked for people who weren't the richest, most powerful, best off. Like the people who benefited from empire at the highest level. If you're not them, what does this world feel like to you? This show gets some of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Something I did think about, the whole switcheroo they play in the brothel with, like, you know, fucking Spartacus and so on. Would your suspicions not be around? I understand why the Roman noble ladies are wearing masks. But surely the gladiators that they're fucking wouldn't be wearing masks, because they've like ordered them up. They know which one it's going to be. And so when he turns up in a mask, would you not be suspicious? Am I being palmed off with some other guy?
I would trust but verify. Would be my general approach to that. In this particular case, wouldn't you notice that the guy you're fucking doesn't have the recently healed wounds that Crixus does?
Yeah, and I mean, also, like, you can't be pimping a man out when he's, you know, he's barely back to full strength.
He proved his vigor. That was trust but verify.
Trust but verify.
Lucretia verified personally and vigorously.
Yeah, and I was also wondering, the characterization of Spartacus is very interesting. Like, would this ancient Thracian man, who's not had sex in God knows how long, refuse a free shag?
He's a man of principle, I guess. So this is one of those ways in which, like, the Spartacus character himself lacks depth. And this particular, the way he's used in this episode is almost purely as a reflection of the other characters around him, right? Like, we don't learn anything new about Spartacus here. He doesn't develop at all over the course of this episode, really. He's just there to serve as a mirror for everybody else's conflicts, desires, etc. Like, Spartacus himself is not driving anything here. He is there to be acted upon and there to be a mirror for everyone
else. He's certainly not there to act. That's one thing we've learned.
Sweet Jesus, man. I love the man. May he rest in peace. Yeah. Nothing but respect for his body of work.
RIP to this Australian man.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we can safely say that skipped a few classes or they didn't take.
And look, acting is hard. You know?
I'm not paid to do it.
No, it's a tough gig. But sometimes you do watch a TV show and you're like, being like the lead in a TV show is the dream of so many actors who can't get work. And then you just sort of think, was this really the best guy you could find?
I mean, yeah. And I think that says everything we need to know. I think that tells us a lot about what was happening production wise here. I love this so much because it knows exactly what it's trying to be. And in the process of trying to be exactly what it's trying to be, they have accidentally, or perhaps intentionally, but more likely accidentally, made stuff that works. And I kind of love that in the process of making like slop, which they knew they were making, they've made really good slop. That has risen above the, you know, the bubbling pot of stew somehow. And I just love that. I love that's happened here.
Yeah. Lovely stuff. There's another element to this plot, which is that, Spartacus, he turns down, this, you know, this free bust from this lady Mira.
I think we're meant to, I think we are the word we're meant to, think about when she comes onto the screen is nubile. We're supposed to think she is a nubile young lady.
Yeah. She's from Nubia. She's nubile. and so he asks her to do something for him. And I wasn't quite clear on what that was.
She's looking for Varro's wife and child.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Because then we do get, because Varro's getting like worked over or something.
So Varro got in a fight. What the fuck did he even get in a fight about? I don't even remember. But he gets in a fight and they got to pull him off and he gets sent to solitary confinement, I guess we're calling it.
Enough people are getting pulled off in this episode already.
just slightly different genre of pulling off there. But yeah. He gets sent to solitary confinement. He's having a rough time and he's lost. And why was he doing this? He was doing it for his wife, but his wife has slept with another man and is pregnant. And like, sorry, bro. I mean, he's going through it.
My man is suffering. He's out here. He's, you know, I mean, you know, you look at this guy and you think he's destined to model for the Bowdoin catalog and yet forced to be a gladiator in ancient Rome. You know, it's a shame. Those boyish blonde ringlet curls. And yet here he is amongst the men, amongst all these Australian men who've been sent to ancient Rome to fight as gladiators.
That's a rough beat, rough spot to be in for him.
It's a tough job, and he's taken out on his wife, which is not great, but you know.
No, we like, look, a lot of things we should be criticizing Varro for here.
Born in the wrong generation, truly.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think we're now reaching, as we're getting closer to the denouement, I think the plots are going to start to come together a little bit more. Whether that rises to the level of being a coherent or even good show, yet to be seen.
Yeah, we'll see if we get a sort of Seinfeldian confluence of all of the plots. taking us back to the early days, you know. Somehow Varro's wife is sucked into this slave rebellion by accident, you know.
Yeah.
She was just buying bread, and then she's been swept up in the crowd.
That's what happens. You just get shoved into the soup Nazi's kitchen one day, and the next thing you know, you're on trial.
Yeah, you'd hate that. I imagine Gladiator's probably eating quite a lot of soup.
So the standard Gladiator diet involved a lot of like porridge. Their diet was extraordinarily high in carbohydrates because of the training demands, right? So and also because if you're holding a little extra body fat, which you will if you're eating a lot of simple carbs, having an extra layer of fat made you less vulnerable to kind of superficial slashing injuries. So, and which was good from the perspective of gladiators, right? Like the crowd wants to see a little bit of blood. So if, you know, the guy,
so all these rich guys would have been fucked.
Yeah. There seems to have been a genuine preference for being a little more of a dad bod in your gladiators. Mm. Like
you need portly chaps in the ludus.
Yeah. I mean, or think Russian journeyman heavyweight boxer.
Oh yeah.
Is that like which is kind of my ideal body type. Like that's kind of what I'm shooting for.
You're trying to look like that 7-foot tall guy who beat lost to David Haye with the inch thick skull.
Oh yeah. One of the Klitschko's?
No. He was like some, I remember there was all this stuff in the, hang on. It was all this stuff in the British media about him because he, Nikolai Valuev, that's his name.
Oh yeah, I remember that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Bond villain henchman looking MF. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I remember in the run up to the fight, there was lots of stuff in the British tabloid press about like this Russian beast, this behemoth with an inch thick skull. There were cross sectional diagrams in the paper of his head. It is definitely the most phrenological the British press has gotten in my lifetime.
That's one of the wonderful things about combat sports is like, you'll be reading an article or listening to an interview or something. And then suddenly someone will bust out like early 20th century race science to explain, to explain something that happened or is going to happen in a fight. And they're like, well, you know, the people of descent from here do have thicker bones and skulls. So I think we should expect a victory. Really? Like I don't feel like that's true. But yeah, boxing, one of the last refuges of straightforward race science.
Yeah, crikey. I mean, look.
I mean, the whole Conor McGregor-Floyd Mayweather fight, which I covered as part of my job 8 years ago, that was basically just replaying a Great White Hope narrative from the early 20th century. Like that, they like beat for beat, they were trying to hit Great White Hope narratives, and they knew that going in. It's very clear if you are aware of the history of Great White Hopes in boxing, that this was the playbook that they had. It goes all the way back more than 100 years, and they just nailed it. And so, yeah, which was brilliant because it made them several hundred million dollars off of that fight, but also suboptimal in perhaps the broader context.
Yeah, I also feel like, you know, if you're going to have a Great White Hope, it's unfortunate that it's Conor McGregor. He wouldn't be my first choice.
Oh,
I don't really want to be. I mean, I don't really want to be being racially represented in any case, but I certainly don't want my race being represented by Conor McGregor. Can we not? Can white people not do better than that?
What a question for like. I think therein you've hit the problem with white supremacy.
Yeah,
the people who want to be held up as visions of the supreme white guy very rarely would fit my criteria for an Ubermensch.
Yeah, it's very funny, isn't it, to be like, to be fully behind the idea we're going to have a which race is better boxing match, which is mad on a number of levels.
Yeah, it's truly insane thing.
And to represent us, Conor McGregor.
I have met Conor McGregor.
Ooh.
I covered this sport for many years. No, this was before he had mastered that. And the really sad thing about Conor McGregor is he is an immensely gifted person. Mm. Like, he's extremely smart. He at least used to be quite self-aware. Mm. He used to, I don't know if this is still true, but 10 years ago or so, like when he was still relatively new, he had a pretty good understanding for his strengths and weaknesses and his own kind of psychology. And as time has gone on, he just watched what I can only assume is massive abuse of cocaine and other drugs. And getting hit in the head for a living is not great for you long term. Mm. And watching him degenerate into the person that he is in the year of our Lord 2025, it should be a cautionary tale for everyone. And it won't be because of how fucking rich he got doing the things that he did.
Yeah, it does. It does feel like we are living in the dumb guy era, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like this fucking Rogan, Andrew Tate, McGregor, like it's sort of, you know, a lot of people take the piss out of these people, but a lot more people love them.
Yes.
And I'm not sure really what you do about that.
I think I called this the counter-reformation of Mother's Most Special Boys. Mm. And I stand by that characterization, that if we view the rise of woke and kind of basically having an awareness of any sort of long-term structural reason why things are the way they are, which has been classified as woke.
Yeah. Knowing stuff.
Yeah.
Engaging with reality, etc.
If we view that as some kind of attempted reformation, right? Mm. This is clearly the counter-reformation of the dumbest motherfuckers on the planet. They are just grasping at power, trying to hold on to it, proclaiming that the world is not as complicated as it actually is, and if we just do dumb guy shit, everything will be fine.
Hustler's and monastery.
One of my dear friends is in the process of launching a call to return these men to voluntary celibacy. Like we need to bring back monasteries for them. They could be secular. Mm. It doesn't matter, but just go and play video games and jerk off with the boys. Like you can do that in a spot. Like that's fine.
A circle, and then it all feels like someone else is doing it.
Exactly. You've got lots of options that aren't misogyny and race science on Twitter. Like you can do better than that, guys. Yeah. Jerk each other off.
Yeah, it is. That's the official Dr. Wyman suggestion.
Yeah, this is a clarion call for mutual masturbation among lonely men.
Yeah, we need to. There we go. Your TikTok presence should take a hard pivot, and you're just there, just encouraging like sort of mentally vulnerable men that they should start wanking each other off. Do would not it be retain worse, any semen, in fact.
Would it be worse than... Here's my honest question to you. I'm not going to do this. But would that be worse than the advice that they are currently getting from lifestyle influencers?
Absolutely not. It would be better.
Yeah. That's how fucked this situation is, man. Like, me going on a social media platform and being like, jerk your bro off. You'll feel better. That's an improvement. That's an improvement over what they're currently getting. Good God, man. Okay.
There you go. This is what we need. We need like the UWC, the ultimate wanking championship.
Maybe the problem is that we have not yet found a way to monetize voluntary celibacy.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm sure we could. I'm sure we could.
Let's table this. We'll come back to it.
Yeah. We're always looking for more ways to monetize the podcast. Maybe we need to get into the vol cell market.
I mean, let's talk.
God, I could never. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it.
Oh my God.
I don't have the strength for the vol cell lifestyle.
No, and you know what? You're not the problem. I'm telling you this as honestly as I can. I don't feel like you're the problem here.
I try not to be the problem.
Very like,
I think generally if you believe women are people, it helps with all this stuff.
Yeah, that should be your baseline understanding here. They have thoughts and feelings, and if you talk to them and ask them questions, they will tell you things about themselves, which gives you more information to treat them as people, and hopefully have a productive and lovely relationship.
Yeah. ask a woman how her day was and be shocked at the positive response you will get for doing what can only be described as the bare minimum. Right, well, that has been an episode of Spartacus Blood and Sand. It's really been Boys Corner this week.
Oh my god, yeah, we've really given you a treatise on how to be a marginally acceptable man in 2025.
Yeah, we're not holding ourselves up as some kind of paragons of virtue.
No,
I was just under the impression that I was further down the pecking order than I actually was.
That's it. And doesn't it feel good to know that you're not?
Yeah, it's great, to be fair. I will. You know what? If it's like, I'm like the guy on the third place podium, like spraying champagne in my own face, like that meme.
I mean, I think we can all agree at this current moment, Pedro Pascal is up there at the very top.
Yeah, probably.
Of the podium.
And most likely.
I salute him. Mm. I'm aiming for third. I'm aiming for that spot.
Those who are about to pod salute you. That's me and Pat on the third place podium wanking each other off. While Pedro Pascal looks on impassively. And we're like, we're doing this for the greater good.
I actually think he would approve of that. I'd like to think that Pedro Pascal would look at that and be like,
if the rumors are true.
Good job, guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, look.
Why not?
Man contains multitudes.
Absolutely. Look, I think this is a free one. So if you listen to this, why not subscribe to the Patreon? Or if you already do subscribe to the Patreon, thank you. But if you don't, why not give it a go? Twice as much of this. There'll be the episode with me and Phoebe from last week, for example, if you want a completely different kind of madness to this. Check that out. It's $5 a month. You get twice as much of this. You know, so if you want advice on being a vole cell, etc.
Consider monasticism.
Yeah, and you also get all the legacy stuff. You get all the old Seinfeld bonuses, the old What's the Deals, all that. There's a treasure trove of content behind that paywall, which you can enjoy. I was remembering the other day about when we did a table read of the Seinfeld 9/11 episode.
What the fuck?
Someone whose name I have unfortunately forgotten, but who we spoke with about doing this, and he gave us his blessing, wrote a spec script a few years ago for what a Seinfeld episode about 9/11 would have been like. And it's so good. It's bang on. And so, yeah, there's good stuff back in the archives, you know?
I want to listen to that. Jesus.
Yeah. I'll send you the link.
I want to hear this really
quick. It was very fun. It was a good team we got together to do it. So yes, thank you very much for listening. Please subscribe to the Patreon. We've been Marlon and Patrick.
Whatever this was.
Yeah. Go out there and speak respectfully to a woman. Do us proud. Bye-bye, everyone.
Goodbye.